101.9 on your FM dial.
It's the Canadian Citizenship Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a rant about what a budget should be, a look at America's first settlers, a segment of Ahead of the Curve, warning about bad science, a look at how we became Canadian citizens, and in honor of the Olympics, a classic Radio Free Thinker segment about doping in sports. Let's begin episode 243.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away from the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. I am Don, your political scientist and skeptical philosopher. This week's rant, the budget. And no, I'm not going to bitch and complain about what was cut or what new project they're starting, but I want to get a little meta on you about this. Now, I looked up the word budget in the dictionary. Oxford's base definition is, quote, an estimate of income and expenditures for a set period of time. In this context, Oxford says an annual or other regular estimate of national revenues expenditures put forth by a finance minister. Now, in common speak, we mean the government promises to spend an extra $12 million in job creation, cut defense by 5%, and yada, yada, yada. You get the idea. Which is very much well and good, but as the former parliamentary budget officer pointed out, proclaiming your intent to do something and actually providing hard numbers is quite a different matter. For example, in the budget, one line states, quote, invest $11 million over 2 years and $3.5 per year ongoing to strengthen the labor market opinion process to ensure Canadians are given first chance at available jobs. Great. This proposal is to strengthen labor market opinion. How? Where is this money going? Are they planning to hire more people, increase inspections, hire contractors to make recommendations? What details are given have nothing to do with the spending. The document says they are, quote, realigning the application stream to better identify vulnerable temporary workers and increase process times of certain applications, limiting the use of program in high unemployment region and ensuring the employers transition to a Canadian workforce through better prevention, detection, and response to employer non-compliance. So, on what exactly is the 11 plus million being spent? It's like I come to you and say, here's my budget. I'm going to spend $1,000 a month on nice things. You might say, what exactly are nice things? Some lines are kind of baffling. Quote, they plan to assert Canada's sovereignty by investing in the North. What does this even mean? If you read down a bit, they state, quote, secure international recognition of the limits of Canada's extended continental shelf, including the North Pole, which is nice, but what the hell does that have to do with the budget? It goes on to say, $40 million over 2 years, starting in 2014-2015, to renew the strategic investment in Northern Economic Development Programs, and $70 million over 3 years, for a new targeted and time-limited fund to increase health services in the three territories, which are budgetee, still very vague. And here's the point of this rant. I'm not commenting on the appropriateness of the aims of this document. I make fun not at their intentions, but well, it's not really a budget. This document, and it's not a conservative thing, this has been going on since forever. I did some research thinking I would uncover some great scam, that 50 years ago, budgets were financial documents about what the government would be spending and where it would be spending it. But alas, no. The only trend I could find is that the budget brief has expanded. The budget brief in 1974 was less than 20 pages. Our current budget brief is over 400 pages. So here is my beef. I have no problem with a in defense of the budget document, which is what Flattery has presented to the Parliament, a document intended to justify the spendings. But there's the rub. It lacks the actual spending. Even the numbers used are abouts, approximates, and roughlies. The budget should say, we are cutting spending, for example, to Environmental Canada by 5% by shutting down the Environmental Lakes project, amounting to a saving of $2 million. Simple, hard numbers. Oh yes, that is also one of the pet peeves at the budget. The budget for this year, again, as the throne speech stated, the plans of the government over the next 10 years are planning to reduce the deficit. Great, but what are you doing this year? What specific things are you cutting this year to get that reduction? Almost every item in the budget was, we plan to spend X amount of dollars over Y number of years. Again, good as a policy statement, but how much are you spending this year? It is, to use the example previously, of $11.8 million over 3 years. So are you spending like $10 million this year, $1 million next year, $0.8 million the year after that? When exactly is this money coming out of the budget? When are we actually spending it? And I understand that governors cannot give too specific a budget. But no, wait a minute. Why not? Okay, I understand that shite happens and you may need to adjust. But could not the Minister of Finance request from each department, agency, Crown Corporation, etc., their projected detailed budgets for the next year, complete with contingencies and caveats? This government, well, we all know the truth, Harper would then review the data and make adjustments. Then this compilation of the complete expected spending of the government would be tabled as the budget. They could then add as much justification, future planning, yada yada, as they want. At least then we would have a real budget. We, the people of Canada, would have one document that would say where this or any government was planning to spend our tax dollars. I think maybe this could become a movement. Bring back the budget, or put dollars back in the budget, or make the budget real. I don't know. You may have your own ideas. If you do, email us, info@radiofreethinker.com. Okay, I think I've ranted enough on this for the moment. We will return after these messages.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Hello and welcome back. The nerd news lately has been the discovery of a tooth from a child 12,600 years old found in western Montana. From this tooth, scientists have been able to decode its DNA. From this DNA, we may have answered one of the most racially charged questions in America. Are the First Nations people truly the First Nation? Before I attempt to answer this question, I need to provide some background. The first part of this is, we are all immigrants, Europeans, Asians, Australians, and quote Americans, in both the continental and nationalist extent. We are all immigrants. The only people who can claim to be truly indigenous are Africans, and even then, not all Africans. So before you write and call in about how X, Y, or Z are the true indigenous people, you are to a large degree splitting hairs. The real elephant in the room, at least in the North American context, is the genocide of Aboriginal people of the America, which is not whether they walked here or not, whether they were first wave or fourth wave. The crime against humanity exists regardless. So that said, I said something about walking here. The First Nations of the Americas settled North America and quickly thereafter Central and South America about 14 to 16,000 years. The current thinking is that the people traveled over a land bridge called Beringia, which became exposed as the ocean levels fell between Alaska and Siberia during the last ice age. Some people believe humans had lived on this middle plain for up to 40,000 years, which is kind of cool and correlates sort of with the date of settlement of Australia, roughly. Why so long there and not just move into Canada? Well, the reason the ocean levels were so low is something called the Ice Age. Most of Canada and North America was covered by miles-high glaciers. This was good because it provided a nice walking path between Asia and the Americas, but not so good because these ice sheets effectively blocked any movement from Beringia to Middle America. Where the trouble begins is that these ice sheets did not significantly retreat until about 12,000 years ago, Obviously, humans were exploring America before that. So how did they get here? Remember, reliable dating puts people in Washington State about 14,000 years ago. Less firmly, but more possibly evidence of people living in Chile almost 15,000 years ago. So how did they get there? Well, for one, we may have the glacier wall thing wrong. The standard theory holds that the path, or thawed valley, existed roughly where Alberta is right now, that allowed the first migration of settlers into the Americas. Well, if we're off on the extent or intensity of the Ice Age, it's possible this passage was made earlier than we once thought. But now enter the Clovis culture. We don't know who they were, but we do know what they left behind. The Clovis arrowheads is a very distinctive type of weapon. Clovis comes from the name of the town in New Mexico where these were first discovered. Evidence of the Clovis people have arguably, and this is a very much argued point, goes back almost 55,000 years ago. Wait a minute. Did I just not say that the ice sheets were an impenetrable obstacle? Okay, maybe you could get people past them via the thawed valley, you know, plus or minus a couple of thousand years. But by more than 4 to 40,000 years, seems highly unlikely. So how do you explain the Clovis people, now regarded as the first immigrants to America? There may have been more than one wave of immigrants. And herein lies the tricky question. Were the, quote, First Nations people really First Nations people? Maybe the Clovis people were the first, but they were supplanted by following waves of immigration from Asia. So when the first body of Clovis people were uncovered, most notably and controversially the Kennewick Man, they were described as having European features. Couple these observations with the rise of the, quote, Tsleil-Waututh hypothesis. The Tsleil-Waututh hypothesis is based on the analysis of the distinctive arrowheads that sort of define the Clovis culture. These are very similar to arrowheads found in France and Spain about 20,000 years ago. The Tsleil-Waututh hypothesis purports that the Clovis people, the first people, were actually from France, and that they traveled to America via ice packs and small boats about 20,000 years ago. This has some scientific importance because if the earliest people are not related to the current Aboriginal people, we can essentially do what we want with the remains. There is, of course, the racist angle that regardless of what happened to the, quote, Indians, Europeans were simply resettling lands that they had actually settled first, that the Americas were originally European anyway. Genocide excused. Okay, not really, but you can understand how some people would look at this as not genuine science, but some sort of racial apologetics. As I mentioned, Kennewick Man was famous not only for his archaeological importance, but for the legal battle over whether he was First Nations or not. If he was, then the current Aboriginal entities have a say in how his remains should be dealt with. Due to centuries of mistreatment, the First Nations people put ceremony above science. Okay, not quite that constrictive, but definitely the science was secondary. So they wanted their ancestors' remains to be buried, and the scientists wanted the remains to be stored in a museum for future study. If Kennewick Man was First Nation, he'd get buried. But if he was a member of a previous First Nation, then the scientists would be able to keep his remains around for scientific study. Debate goes back and forth. One new theory has arisen that the people of Asia could have colonized the Americas thousands of years earlier than thought if they'd used the coast. Those of us who live on the West Coast know that things stay pretty much frost-free all year long, even in the deepest of winter. Thank you, Pacific Ocean. This is true today and likely true 20,000 years ago. This means that instead of trekking through the thawed valley, people could have migrated along the West Coast thousands of years earlier than thought. This boat migration was more plausible than a European trek because these settlers always had a land to settle on as they moved south to more ice-free regions. More and more archaeological evidence is being discovered showing settlements in this period along the coast. Now we return to the child and her tooth. DNA sequencing shows this child is related to 80% of the current Aboriginal population. She was buried with Clovis artifacts. So it would seem that the Clovis people were ancestors to the current population of First Nations. Okay, case closed. Or not. Well, first, I should point out that even if the child was directly descended slash related to most of the current native populations, this child could have been, forgive the simplicity of this assertion, could have been adopted, or the result of some sort of interbreeding. One child that does not make a culture. Two, the evidence of the Clovis people date back 5,000 plus years from this child. A lot can happen, especially when one culture is squeezing out another. Think humans and Neanderthal. The strongest evidence for, quote, human origins of the Clovis people, and I say Europeans in the same way that you might say the Iraqis are Babylonians, so yes and no, there is some genetic markers that point to a non-Asian relationship. However, if we accept the many migrations theory, there are genetic markers that reappear. The European variant of the C4C is similar to the Asian X2A, perhaps parallel genetic evolution. That said, the scientific evidence still shows genetically there's a mystery to be solved. So how do I end this segment? Well, I think it is possible that, quote, Europeans could have settled part of America, however unlikely that may be. I also acknowledge that people of Asia, if not in one but many migrations, settled the Americas and are now what we call the native peoples. But who really cares which came first? At the root of this is a great crime that was committed against the Aboriginal peoples of the Americas, regardless they were first, second, or 12th. The knowledge that the Jews were not the founding people of Germany made no difference to the crimes that the Nazis had committed. In the same sense, it makes no difference who was first to acknowledge an atrocity occurred. Well, on that, Godwin, we will be back after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
I'm ahead of the curve. Take a piece of the sunshine with me on a red eye flight to another world. It isn't any trouble if you wanna come with me. You can get what you want now. Knock it out of the park. Bury it by the river. Easy, there's a search party, but it's getting dark. Staying above the flat line, I'm ahead of the curve. Take a piece of the sunshine with me on an all-night drive to another world.
Welcome to Ahead of the Curve, a segment intended to keep you aware and pre-armed for a scientific quackery that may be coming out in the future, but has yet to hit the mainstream media. This week, we're going to talk about an article that is starting to make the rounds, claiming that a plethora of chemicals are responsible for retardation in our youth. In a paper, sadly published in The Lancet, Philip Grandjean and Philip Landergan make the claim that, well, here's a synopsis of their paper. Brace yourself, it's a little wordy. Neurodevelopmental disabilities, including autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, dyslexia, and other cognitive impairments affect millions of children worldwide, and some diagnoses seem to be increasing in their frequency. Industrial chemicals that injure the developing brain are among the known causes for this rise in prevalence. In 2006, we did a systematic review and identified five industrial chemicals as developmental neurotoxins: lead, methylmercury, chlorinate, biphenyls, arsenic, and toluene. In 2006, epidemiological studies have documented six additional developmental neurotoxins: manganese, fluoride, chloropyrifos, dichlorodiphenyl, trichloroethane, tetrachloroethylene, and polybromide diphenyls esters. We postulate that even more neurotoxins remain undiscovered. To control the pandemic of developmental neurotoxicity, we propose a global prevention strategy. Untested chemicals should not be presumed to be safe to the brain's development, and chemicals in existing use and all new chemicals must therefore be tested for developmental neurotoxicity. To coordinate these efforts and to accelerate translations of science into prevention, we propose the urgent formation of a new international clearinghouse. Okay, now first, there are some things that should make you question, but not necessarily dismiss, this study. First, it is not so much reporting effects, but advocating actions. They state obviously an anti-chem bias by stating that all new untested chemicals should not be presumed safe. Don't get me wrong, if this was an article in HuffPo, well, that is in the realm of advocacy. In a research paper, it does call into question the neutrality vis-a-vis the data of the researcher. There are also some other questionable lines in the write-up. They make one sentence where they say, some diagnoses seem to increase the influence. So there's more an implied as opposed to causal. But then they go right into the next one where they say these industrial chemicals are known to cause this increase in affliction. So the science seems to be a little off there. Also, it is not actually an experiment. It is a study of other experiments. Not fatal in and of itself, but we must ask questions about methodology. In a normal experiment, the methodology is used for other scientists to replicate the results. However, in a meta-study such as this, the methodology is important to know what studies were included and which ones weren't included, and why, and how were the results normalized. A little side note here. The term normalized is used a lot in science. It essentially means to make equal. That is, not every study is exactly identical. The job of a meta-researcher is to attempt to make each study compatible to another so that they can be assessed as a large sort of super study. For an extremely simple example, if a study in the US used gallons and a study in Canada used liters, the process of normalization would be to convert the studies into a single measure. In reality, this job of normalization can be more nuanced and difficult. For example, a study of men using Viagra has some results, while another study of young women using hypertension medication had other results. Both studies were overlapping, for lack of a better word, in the area of vascular diuretics, things that make the blood vessels open up. But most men using Viagra are, how shall we say, in their autumn years, whereas the women studied involved were people in their 20s. How you account for the age and the gender difference, this is called normalization. Okay, so let's go back to our study. A number of scientists are pointing out that the paper lacks, quote, rigor. That is, the paper looked at 27 studies, but if you looked at 27 other studies, no effect was found. Normally, I would have ignored this paper as perhaps biased, but well, science is not pristine. I bring it to listeners' attention because first, the author has written a book about the ills of chemical, as if we could eliminate chemicals from our lives. Okay, there's an inside joke here, perhaps. Normal people think of chemicals as something unnatural and unusual. However, the nerd crew know that everything is a chemical or an element. Your food is a chemical. Your poo is chemicals. Water is chemicals. Even pure H2O is a chemical. Oxygen, well, that's an element, but it's also a chemical. People think of chemicals as something made in a lab and likely to be bad. That is not true. It is the claim that this paper makes to, quote, all new chemicals must therefore be tested. That has me jazzed and wants to make sure people are ahead of the curve.
I'm ahead of the curve. Take a piece of the sunshine with me on an all-night drive to another world.
There's God standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Freethinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Freethinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome back. Okay, shifting gears a little. I was listening to a discussion on the CBC where someone was pushing to make it more difficult to become a Canadian citizen. Discussions like these are happening on the eve of the government introducing a new bill that will reform the Canadian Citizenship Act. The reforms will likely include things like extending the wait time before a landed immigrant can apply for citizenship while speeding up the actual application once they've actually made it. Also, ensuring that they actually live in Canada 4 out of 5 years. Some had argued that if you live outside the country for too many years, your citizenship should be revoked. The logic there is some people get Canadian citizenship as sort of a safety net. If they get sick, they can return to Canada for health care. If they get in legal trouble, they can fall back on Canada as a refugee sort of thing. Of course, the current bill is avoiding one of the major issues, baby tourism. And I must confess, I don't have the numbers to substantiate whether this is really a problem or not. But this is a practice where some pregnant women come to Canada as tourists to give birth to the children so that, in the future, their child could claim Canadian citizenship. This would allow the kids to completely sidestep the whole immigration process. Oh yes, and the law will bestow upon the government the power to revoke citizenship under, quote, extreme circumstances. Jaw drops to the floor. Okay, I'm going to stop here because this requires an entire segment all on its own. But alas, not today. Now, it happens during this discussion I learned an interesting fact. So pop quiz. Who were the first Canadians? Okay, yes, First Nations people. But no, what I mean is, in what year could you find an official, legal, quote, Canadian citizen? Well, you're wrong. Well, you were if you said 1967. Now, some might say it was 1910 when the Immigration Act actually used the word Canadian citizen, but only in reference to people who lived in Canada and not as citizens of the nation of Canada. British subjects were considered de facto citizens, and the main target was actually to prevent undesirable people, i.e. colored and the Jews, from entering Canada freely. Only a little over a decade later was the term Canadian national used in the Canadian National Act. All these terms were sort of subcategories, though, of British subjects. You were first and foremost a citizen of the British Empire, then one of the sub-nations. On your passport, it said British subject. It was not until 1931, in the Statutes of Westminster, that Canada was actually no longer considered a colony of Britain, but an independent nation. Wait, hold on, you might say. Didn't that happen in 1867? No, not really. Our independence was more evolutionary than revolutionary. But even with this apparent graduation into nationhoods, we were still considered British subjects. This all changed with the passage of the Citizenship Act in 1946, which made, as of January 1st, 1947, all people born in Canada naturalized citizens. British citizens who lived in Canada for more than 20 years, spouses of Canadians and their children. At a stroke of midnight, we were magically transformed from boring British subjects to proud Canadian citizens. We were the first colony to be peacefully separated from the empire and the first to define their own sense of citizenship. Take that, Australia! Proud? Damn right I'm proud. But now you might think I am playing the sense of pride too much. But listen to a CBC report on the event in 1947. How we have changed as a people since then. But listen to the subdued pride, the truly Canadian sense of achievement in his voice when you listen to him describe the events that happened January 1st, 1947.
New Year's Day, 1947. Today, for the first time, Canadians officially became Canadians. through the Canadian Citizenship Act. Tonight we've asked Blair Fraser, Ottawa editor of Maclean's magazine, to explain what the new status means to us. He speaks from Ottawa.
You may not have noticed it, but a change came over most of us today. For the first time in any real or full sense of the word, we're Canadian citizens. Up to and including yesterday, when we called ourselves Canadians, it didn't mean very much more than a kind of regional tag like Blue Nose or Sourdough. Showed where you were born. When we got a passport, it didn't call us Canadian. It read British subject by birth. The census taker wouldn't let you put yourself down as plain Canadian. You had to hyphenate it. English Canadian, Ukrainian Canadian, so on. The term Canadian citizen had only one meaning. For the narrow purposes of the Immigration Act, it meant a person entitled to free entry into the country. And then for the new Canadian, the man born abroad who was entering the fellowship of this country with all its rights and responsibilities, we used to swear these people in job lots like a coroner's jury. There was far more solemnity and formality about becoming a Boy Scout than about becoming a Canadian. The Oath of Allegiance didn't even contain the word Canada. Well, all that came to an end today. Today, the new Canadian Citizenship Act came into effect. We're still British subjects, of course, but our passports won't any longer lump us in with all the other British subjects on whom the sun never sets. Those coming into the Canadian nation will do it in future with some dignity and ceremony, the first ceremony taking place here in Ottawa the day after tomorrow. For the people born or already naturalized here, nothing actually happens. We all become Canadian citizens automatically without doing anything. But the men who framed the new act did hope that even for us it would mean something, that in thus defining and clarifying the status of a Canadian, it would give us perhaps a new pride in our country, perhaps a new awareness of the rights we enjoy and the duties that we undertake. This is Blair Fraser speaking from Ottawa.
On that patriotic note, let's end the segment with the most appropriate of songs. Return with some classic Radio Free Thinker after this break.
Canada pays some of the highest cell phone fees in the industrialized world, and now the big three companies that control 94% of the market want us to pay more? Using high-priced lobbyists, the big three are trying to trick the government into shutting out independent competitors. If they succeed, they will squeeze more money out of your wallet and squeeze Canadians into tighter contracts. Send a message to the industry minister. We want competition. We want independent providers. Stand up. Sign this urgent petition. Visit stopthesqueeze.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So, Don, you may have heard of this fellow named Lance Armstrong.
Did he go on the moon?
No. But, you see, Lance Armstrong was a cyclist.
Oh?
And he apparently won some awards or something. I don't know. Anyway, so this guy, unfortunately, though, has just brought so much shame on his family name. His ancestors, Neil and Louis, must be just spinning in their graves.
Wait a minute. I'll stop you there, Ethan. You, nor I prior to my research, may not be aware, but Lance even faked his name, kind of. He's not actually Armstrong by birth, but by marriage. His stepfather was Armstrong. Lance's biological father was Gunderson, who was Norwegian by ancestry. So, you know, famous people like Neil Armstrong, Louis Armstrong, I think there's someone who's a baseball player named Armstrong, I'm sure there's lots. They needn't feel any shame about what may or may not be talked about today, because I'm pretty sure we're not talking about Lance Armstrong's ancestry, are we?
No, well, maybe a future show. So, basically, we're talking about Armstrong. As everyone knows, he's in the news. We're going to talk about it from a couple different angles. So, recently, after decades of denying allegations of cheating, Armstrong finally admitted to decades of cheating on a special interview with Oprah recently. So as skeptics, I think we can look at this from two perspectives. The first is sort of the rationality behind doping rules, performance-enhancing drugs, and sort of the philosophy of the concept of fair play. So to start off with some science and some facts, there are several different kinds of, quote, performance-enhancing drugs. And we've actually discussed this before when we were talking about the London Olympics. But to quickly recap, we have things like anabolic steroids. These are the drugs that mimic the effects of testosterone in the body. They come with a whole host of side effects, including some pretty dangerous ones. They're banned by most sporting leagues in the world. There's the human growth hormones, which are supposed to grow muscle mass, although there's very limited scientific evidence that they actually do anything. And there's blood doping, which is, this is the sort of main one that Lance Armstrong has been involved in. This is to boost the number of red blood cells in the body, giving the athlete more oxygen and endurance. And this can be done with either transfusions or the drug EPO. So the question is, do these substances give an unfair advantage to athletes who take them? The science seems to be unable to give us a satisfactory answer. Given that most of these are illegal, it's really hard to do any kind of long-term controlled studies to see what the effects are. It is apparent, however, from the amount of athletes who are using the drugs that many believe them to be giving them a significant advantage. That's hard to pin down as well, because, I mean, there are athletes who probably wear power balance bracelets, for goodness sakes.
Actually, and there is research done that the placebo effect is actually a major factor in a lot of professional sports.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So last time we talked about doping, we pondered over the difference between, say, taking drugs to get an advantage and having an advantage from some other source, perhaps, you know, if you have access to better trainers and equipment, that sort of thing. So I would argue that sporting leagues at some point have to draw a line between, or, well, defining what cheating is. Now, admittedly, it's going to be an arbitrary line because there's no objective form of cheating, of course. But we need to, at some point, figure out what's going to be allowed and what isn't going to be allowed. And I think that drawing that line at performance-enhancing drugs is a pretty good place to put it. Because, I mean, even if we assume, for instance, that they're not terribly effective, but I think that we know, for example, that blood doping is probably one of the more effective forms. Giving you that oxygen boost is a pretty big advantage. So I think drawing that line at drugs is a pretty good place to start for a couple of reasons. One, I think most of these drugs are already illegal in most countries. In fact, the U.S. has pretty strict rules on possession of these drugs without a prescription. So it's not really fair for U.S. athletes if, Canadians are able to take these pills that would get an American thrown in jail for 10 years or even having them on their person. Another reason would be health risks. We know that sports are dangerous activities. And in fact, we're finding out pretty recently that they could even be deadly. Head injuries in hockey and football, for instance, have really shown us that there are some pretty long-term and frightening results from repeated concussions. Nevertheless, having athletes secretly injecting drugs in locker rooms is really not any kind of better situation. The pressure for athletes to dope up to compete could lead them to take the wrong kind of performance-enhancing drug, or it could lead them to take something that's going to be really bad for them. There are a lot of health risks for many of these drugs. And because they're illegal, they're going to be less inclined to get help for it, which is something that we talked to Dr. Thomas Kerr about, that if it's illegal, you're less likely to seek out medical attention. Now, another reason, and this goes to sort of creating that, quote, level playing field. Most sports leagues have kind of equal footing when it comes to training. So, for example, the Vancouver Canucks don't really have an advantage over, say, the Detroit Red Wings when it comes to trainers or equipment. I mean, both teams are going to have very large budgets for that kind of thing. Their athletes are going to be able to get training year-round in the summer during the league. They're going to have access to some really good doctors, that kind of thing. In some cases, very proactive doctors, as we learned about the Calgary Flames. Now, this is the exception to this, of course, is the Olympics, because athletes are supposed to be amateurs in the Olympics. Well, supposed to be. They're not really anymore. And they don't really have access to these resources. And I think one of the most stark examples was in the London Games. I think the gold medal, the women's gold medal weightlifter was living like below the poverty line or something in America. So some countries throw significant resources at training Olympic athletes. Some countries don't. So that creates a really uneven playing field. So athletes feel inclined to take performance-enhancing drugs. And also, which was pointed out to me earlier, that wealth disadvantage also works for performance-enhancing drugs, because you have wealthier athletes that can afford performance-enhancing drugs versus athletes who can't. So that's why I think that drawing that line in the sand, saying, okay, listen, we're gonna let you throw as much money as you want training yourself, but as soon as you start crossing over that line into illegal substances, we're going to kick you out.
So, Ethan,
yeah.
And our audience members, you like a little fire, so I'm going to throw in a little fire here. You hypocrite, you. No. So there are some things in here that I think I would take, I don't know if exception with, but so first of all, the fact that some of these drugs are illegal are not necessarily illegal for any necessary health reasons, right? They're illegal because, as you say, they are deemed to be unfair. So that's kind of a circular logic there, that a number of these drugs, if we said it was okay to dope in sports, would not be illegal in themselves.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. I mean, the reason that things like steroids are illegal has a lot to do with sort of the social taboo of using them. But, I mean, they can also be dangerous on their own.
Which leads into the second part where you talked about when Dr. Carr was in here, that one of the things that makes drug use in the sense of heroin and all that dangerous is the fact that, A, it's illegal, and, B, these people are sort of self-medicating. They don't have health professionals to help you. Whereas if we took drug doping out of the closet, out from the shadows, that where, you know, you didn't have to do it in secret in your locker room, but you actually had a trained physician and you were doing it with the trained physician to make sure that you not only got a benefit from it, but you didn't sacrifice your health at the same time, I think that would alleviate your number two criticism with regards to that.
Well, what I would say to that, I agree. Like, if you had someone there who could advise the athletes, I think the best way out of that would be basically to have a policy in sporting leagues is that if you do take performance-enhancing drugs that are against the rules, and you go to your team doctor or whoever and say, listen, I've been taking these drugs, have a blanket policy of saying, okay, well, everybody makes mistakes, so we're not going to punish you. We're not even going to publicize it. The league will know, but no one else will, and we're going to, you know, show you how to not take them and et cetera, and how to do it safely. So basically, and this is something that I've actually heard a couple times before, Michael Shermer, who is an avid cyclist, has talked about how to get rid of doping is to basically say, okay, everyone who's done it now, we're not going to punish you. It's the only way to sort of bring it out of the woodwork, so to speak, to get people to talk about it. So I think that you can have an open policy on it without making it not against the rules.
So, but again, I it still seems, as you point out, arbitrary, but I think unnecessarily arbitrary to have banned them. And this goes into your third part. And on this, I think I'm going to say yes and no is one of my favorite lines to say.
Mm-hmm.
So with regards to the Olympic athletes or that sort of thing, I think it's much easier to make this arbitrary line in the sand that we need to have something fair and balanced. Although that being said, as you just said, that's actually an impossibility, because not only do you have the idea of drug enhancements, you have training enhancements, lifestyle enhancements, those sort of things. And oddly enough, I think if the Olympics wanted to do that, they would sort of supply all of the wear for all, and then athletes would sort of apply to use this facilities, and then you'd actually have sort of your level playing field. But the other part of it is, in your example, you use the Canucks. And we were talking a little before the show that things like professional sports is actually entertainment. It's not really sports. Sports is the excuse, but it's really entertainment. At which point, the more entertainment, the more better, if you know what I mean. I mean, as long as, again, there has to be factors about health and that idea. So I'm not saying, you know, we should allow athletes to shoot up with PCB before a game because that'll make for a more exciting game. That's taking it. So we're assuming that these are performance-enhancing drugs that under medical conditions seem to be safe, and that this is a sporting entertainment sort of event, and as you point out, they'd all more or less be able to apply equally because they're all rich people or have access to the same sort of facilities. I don't see why that would be an unlevel playing field.
Well, I'm actually going to get to that point in our next section. So now we're going to get a bit philosophical here, discussing Armstrong. So he cheated. What does that mean for our perception of fair play and honesty? Well, let's look at some of the context here, because this is obviously a special case. Not only was Armstrong put on a pedestal for his achievements of being a top athlete and after a battle with cancer, he was sort of the poster boy for hard work paying off, et cetera, et cetera.
Thanks, Nike.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the course of his career, Armstrong was actually in reality kind of a jerk. He took millions in endorsements and charity. He would sue newspapers and journalists that accused him of doping, which we know he was lying about. And he would also bully his teammates into doping, or he would have them thrown off the team.
And it's important to note, especially with the suing journalists and all that, he just didn't sue them. I mean, he went after them.
Oh, yeah.
Like a pit bull to a raw steak. I mean, he was vicious and violent, and I mean, this is where he's more than just a bad person.
He's gonna get it, because I mean, I was just reading an article, I think the Daily Mail in the UK, he sued them for about £1 million. Now they're coming back at him, and they want all of it back, plus £100,000 in interest. I mean, and the thing is, too, like, the sad aspect of this is that he would donate a lot of this money to his charity. So now you're in the position of revoking money from a cancer charity, which I think, I mean, it's just kind of a terrible situation. And it's, you know, really stupid that he did this. So anyway, we can say his actions are quite despicable. And this leads to the question of why do we feel this way? You know, we don't seem to like cheaters is the easy answer. You know, if you're playing a board game with somebody and you found out someone was cheating, you're likely going to be annoyed and you don't want to play with them. This concept of competition is that it's a structure with a set of guidelines that everyone adheres to, and that breaking these guidelines spoils the competition. And you can even apply this to things like academics. If you look at a course as a competition, the final exam is, you know, your guidelines. You have, you know, no phones, no leaving the room, no books and such. And if you're doing your final exam and you look over and you see someone with an iPad and a list of books and sources and stuff like that, and they get an A+ and you get a C, you're going to be rather annoyed by this.
But, well, what if you got an A+? What if they got an A+ and you got an A? Would that, I mean, so that okay, we'll skip that part. There is an interesting evolutionary psychological reason that we don't like the idea of cheating, is that if you're in a social community group, and everyone is expected to carry their weight to do some task for the group. Let's say fight a battle to defend yourself against the bad guys over the hill. And I'm fighting, risking my life, and I find out Ethan here is hiding behind a rock. He's sort of cheating. Well, that kind of makes him a detriment to our community, and there's a very strong social pressure to make sure that everyone follows the same rules. Ironically enough, of course, we have the same evolutionary pressure pushing against that because Ethan, I shouldn't make you sound like a coward, but you're actually a genius because by hiding behind the rock, you're less likely to die, which means your genes are much more likely to continue. So we have this bi-directional sort of push where as a society, we want everyone to be on the same playing field, but as an individual, we all sort of have this urge to cheat because that is to our own personal advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the context of gaming, though, and again, like I say, there's sort of the two levels here. If you're dealing with the Olympics, I think there's a much more stronger sense that that you want to have this sense of fair play. even though, again, I think it's an impossibility to achieve, but we'll go with the illusion. But when you go with sport attainment, I don't quite see why it needs to seem to be as fair as you necessarily mean, as long as it's entertaining. I mean, everyone goes into it, they know what's going on, and they still enjoy it. I mean, you watch a movie about where, you know, the bad guy gets killed in the end, you're not annoyed that the whole movie was against the bad guy. You're like, well, this was a fun movie, I'm glad I watched it. And even with the sports teams, if they're all doping, it's still a level, it's a raised level playing field, or lowered, I guess, depending on your ethical stance, but it still has that, they're not cheating, right?
Because if
everyone's following the same rules, and if part of that rule is you're allowed to take performance-enhancing drugs, then I don't see where it is an unfair playing field. Again, I think the Olympics is a different kind of case, but for professional sports, if all the teams and all the players are allowed to take performance-enhancing drugs, that strikes me as still a level playing field.
Well, assuming, though, that they are legal and that people want to use them. See, the thing is, there is this idea that, you know, if someone is going to be doing sports, whether it's baseball or hockey or something like that, we expect to see extraordinary levels of athleticism. So, you know, it's not good enough to see a Wayne Gretzky or someone score 500 goals. We want to see 1,000 goals. And, you know, it's not good enough to have someone win the home run derby. We want to see them smash the records every time. So I think the flaw behind this thinking is that it's not in an isolated vacuum. Because if you look at the NHL, for example, it's not just the NHL. It's also the AHL, which is the farm league. And then you have the junior hockey league under that. And then you have, you know, kids playing hockey under that. And then you also, of course, have international competition. So if the NHL allows doping and the European Hockey League doesn't, basically it's wiped out international play, because you can't have the two leagues work this out. If you want to have a uniform, that's why I say it has to be a uniform arbitrary system in place so that every league follows the same set of rules.
Yeah, but again, I'm going to go back to the Olympics, and you're more a sports person than me, so maybe I'm wrong in this idea. But one of the recent, quote, innovations of the Olympics was to allow professional players to play on Olympic teams. So when you have the Canadian Olympic hockey team, they're NHL players on that hockey team, which really seems to be unfair for the Kenyan hockey team, who obviously probably doesn't have as many NHL players on it.
Not as many, no.
Right. So, but at the same time, though, I mean, this is still seemed to be a level playing field in the context that it's allowed.
Well, I don't think it's quite the same. I mean, like, it's sort of, you know, you could look at Usain Bolt, the fastest guy in the world type thing. Can anyone name any of the other like six guys who were in that race? It's like you only remember the guy who won. And likewise, I think that sort of factors in. It's not a question of the Olympics of, you know, universal fair play. Everyone knew going into that race that Usain Bolt was going to win. It wasn't like, you know, the guy from France was going to beat him.
No, but just to make sure, there are differences amongst, I mean, you use your European, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, the American Hockey League, or the hockey rinks that we use here, are different dimensions than what they use in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's an unfair advantage, however, whichever way you want to play that. I mean, if we're in Europe, I guess the Europeans have the advantage, because I think it's a bigger rink. And right?
It's a bigger rink in Europe, and it's a smaller rink in North America, yeah.
So again, I think you have a stronger argument with the idea that, you know, do we want to have a society that is medicating children into this sort of sports line? But then I would go back, and I mean, I think one of the things I remember, the American Olympics they had in, the big one in the 80s, 84 Olympics, which was in some place. Anyhow, one of the people there had won the ice rink or whatever, and they had this big thing about how, you know, since she was like 6 years old, 6 a.m. in the morning, 5 a.m., dad would get up and they'd drive her to the rink and she'd skate. Well, that strikes me as a horrible thing to do to a child. I mean,
well, unless they enjoy it.
Well, but do they? I mean, does a six-year-old child naturally have the urge to skate 3 hours every morning, every day?
Well,
or is there like, well, you know, you like skating. Do you want to be good? Well, let's go get you onto this program.
Well, I mean, there's a certain extent of that. I mean, like, you can look at someone like Wayne Gretzky, who was practically born on the ice. I mean, A lot of people who play, a lot of the kids who play professional sports usually do so because they like it and they don't want to stop. I mean, that was my experience with it, at least. The kids who don't enjoy it usually, you know, don't play very well and they don't stick with it.
Well,
so
you get the example, and again, I hate to fall into stereotypes here, the Chinese gymnastic team or whatever, I mean, if I remember correctly, the last Olympics, there was lots of sort of stories going around that these were not kids who really wanted to do this, but they were picked up and then they were put into this stream. And even if they kind of wanted to do with it, there's a lot of brainwashing going on that this is what you want to do. So my point is that, I mean, the fact that we push a lot of this stuff on children at a very young age, that in itself can be seen as a negative. And I agree, I don't think we should be doping up kids when they're like 10 years old, but I don't think we should be making them run 5 hours every morning because of the same ideal that you're going for.
Well, I think that's a separate argument, though. Like, I don't think we can excuse one type of bad behavior with another. I think that we have to figure out what is the best course of action for the whole system. And I think that taking a sort of prohibitionist stance with doping is probably one of the better options for the whole
thing. And I will not disagree with you on that. But, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, fighting in junior leagues is banned, right? I mean, you're not...
Most of them, yeah.
When you're in the
junior
leagues...
Well, when you're a little kid, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's... And it, even if in the like, not... like, if you're 15 years old or whatever... Even
I think
there,
it comes in, like, around 18 or something.
Right. So, but I mean, fighting in professional hockey happens all the time, and it's considered to be part of the strategy of hockey. I mean,
well,
at least it was in my day.
It was, yeah.
Right?
It's banned in pretty much every other league, too.
Okay, but the idea is, though, is that you have the professionals doing one thing,
mm-hmm.
but the amateurs aren't allowed. So the professionals can be taking drugs because they made it to that level.
Well, that actually goes into sort of what we were talking about. We're almost out of time, but quickly, about sports injuries. The way that we're changing our perception about, like, concussions. And you look at how, you know, it wasn't that long ago that hockey players didn't wear helmets. You know, you would see Bobby Orr or somebody without a helmet on. You think nowadays that's crazy, but that was one of the things. And you look at how we've changed our perception of young people playing sports. And ironically, one of the more interesting things I heard about this was, I think on an episode of Penn and Teller, they were talking about injuries in football, comparing it to, like, I don't know, other injuries. And it is quite brutal. And I think that we're changing our perception of what we're willing to tolerate for kids and what we're willing to tolerate for, you know, grown adults. And it is a pretty interesting argument about, you know, the new regulations that we're seeing happening at the grassroots level for kids and how it's working its way up the ladder. I mean, you're getting this kind of the old guard in the NHL who don't want to wear visors and they don't want to wear neck guards. And you have a generation of kids who have been said, no, you're wearing visors and you're wearing neck guards, whether you want to or not. And as they come into the league, it's changing the perception of you know, sort of tough guy machoism into more sort of like, no, I kind of want to use my eyes when I'm like, you know, 45 years old.
You're saying ethics are evolving.
They might be.
So Ethan, I have a confession.
Yeah.
Before the show, I took a performance-enhancing drug. I took caffeine, which stimulates the brain. So I don't think we've had a fair playing field on the show.
Well, next time you can take some more caffeine and we'll level things out a bit. So we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinker.
This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose, a morning filled with 400 million suns. Rising of the Milky Way. Cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite.
Yeah.
Listen up, Canadians, it's time to heed the call. Our destiny's before us, enough of thinking small. Put on your toque and grab a flag, it's time to colonize. I think the other nations will be quite surprised. When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
We'll put curling rinks in Africa and hockey everywhere, and force the Americans to have free health care. We'll bring winter to Australia, to France we'll bring poutine. Then we'll conquer Britain and install our queen. When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
And we shall tell them what to do, and if they say they won't, we shall ask again politely. And if they still don't, we will tell them it's alright. We don't mean to criticize, but perhaps they would consider some form of compromise. When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada, Canada.
When Canada rules the world,
Canada.
Things will be. Wasn't that long?